Processing is a combination of significances, spaces, and masses. And though I would like to go along at once and immediately with a chap by the name of Siddhartha, you know him as Gautama Buddha, I'd like to go along with him at once back there in 600 and something B.C. because he was a fine chap. His adjuration not to have anything to do with separateness or non-separateness and in effect spaces and masses and energies may or may not have been said by Gautama Buddha, but it certainly is a red herring on the track of Buddhism, which could only get there in a not-have part of the world, such as the East. Now, we look this over and we discover then the importance of our tools. It is highly doubtful if Buddhism ever reached any of its goals. This becomes very doubtful, because the hottest process that we have, even by contemplation of one's navel, one would have to enter this as one of the processes, would be separateness. And Gautama Buddha tells us that separateness and non-separateness are not germane to the problem. He says so specifically in his statements and dialogues that are allegedly made to one of his boys, which occupies one of the main books of Buddhism. There are 12 things there you mustn't pay any attention to, and if you do, something like, if you think of, you can always turn lead into gold in the full of the moon on a hill using a fire and crucible, so long as you don't think of the word hippopotamus. But if you think of the word hippopotamus, the lead will not turn to gold. So he gives 12 things that you're not supposed to have anything to do with, and he says it's mind essence. Now, maybe somebody could suddenly come along and say mind essence, and he'd be somewhere or nowhere and be clear. Maybe. Maybe. But we've been slugging at this now for about 5 years on a very broad front. There's been a lot of smart boys besides myself working on this. And we have done the horrible thing in SLP issue 5 of bend unintentionally in the direction of one Siddhartha. And I assure you that if exteriorization and power and freedom from this universe could be attained by a single thought, I can assure you we would have thought that thought by this time. Because we have thought every possible combinations of thoughts, even by symbolic logic, have actually worked out how many thoughts there were that could be thunk. And here we put out SLP issue 5 and we omit havingness. And havingness consists of space. And it consists of energy and it consists of mass. And we had the space there, all right, in separateness, its processes of separateness. We had energy there in spotting energy sources. But we didn't have the mass, and nobody went free. Fascinating. That's one of the broadest tests that could possibly be made, because auditors all over the world were using SLP 5. And their gains were proportionately low, I'm sure, to clinical gains, which were being very carefully monitored and measured. By the excellence of the auditor's presence, by his interest, by the fact that he listened to somebody's problems, we, of course, got gains. But the moment we omitted havingness, those gains must then have been transient and must have evaporated as the mass ran out. And so we take, honestly, our first major departure and disagreement from all philosophy of the past, and cut free at once of a tradition which has existed amongst men for 10,000 years that we have some inkling of. And we're free of that tradition. The first studies which were undertaken in Scientology had to do with Eastern philosophy, mysticism, later on spiritualism, later on magic. These subjects were very thoroughly covered. And if the goal had been attained in any one of these subjects, believe me, with the people who were talked to and known in these fields, had been able to accomplish anything, evidence would have arisen. One heard about a great many things that had been or could be accomplished, but they were all sort of historical. One hears of these things, but he looks in vain. He looks and he looks and he looks. Man has so tired of looking for these miracles springing from these fonts that anyone coming along today and saying, we have something, is at once suspect of charlatanism. There's where you get the odium of Scientology doesn't work, as some people believe. But they believe this on an engramic significance. They think there is no cure, there is no remedy. On the person who says to you, Scientology won't work, he would run at once and very arduously with fabulous Carmelags, is there is no cure. You just ask him to hold that as an idea and he just drops to the bottom. He also can't arrive. So this is quite interesting that we would get a hangover of this character and a generalized engram of this character in the human race. There's no cure, there's no remedy. Here we are slaves, we are downtrodden, we are unable to escape, we have lost our power of choice, we have lost our commands of our own destiny. There once was a game here, of this we are sure, but we are not at this time playing a game. Everywhere we look, we see penalties, and we ourselves are involved continuously with penalties. Where is the game? Therefore, it is not a game. It's a vale of tears and a valley of sighs. Now, wherever you look, then, amongst men, you will find that his past tradition has led him to believe that there is no remedy and that nothing can be done along this line. If something were possible along this line, I assure you, it would have been seen. You or I would have seen it rather clearly. Now and then we read in the newspaper about somebody's magical recovery of sight. He went to bed blind and he prayed just before he went to bed and he woke up seeing very, very well. And we read of this sort of thing, this miraculous recovery level. Fabulous. But we hear about it. We have tracked back several of these, and the mechanism involved lies well within the realm of Scientology. We already understand the mechanism of occurrence. He didn't just pray. Something else happened. He fell downstairs and then prayed. Something occurred that would disturb his mass, impact, significance ratio. Something occurred. Now, an individual who is totally enmeshed and overly burdened with mass need only look for some space and find some separateness and indulge in a little communication to get an occasional manic-type release. This lies well within this. We can take Preclear, and we can audit him in the direction of havingness and nothing but havingness and just start crowding it to him, you know, just crowd it to him, just a little more and a little more and a little more. He will eventually be prepared for some freedom. He will eventually be prepared to release a problem. It's almost impossible, really, to distinguish between havingness and a problem. Odd that one is a substitute for the other. Sometimes, however, you can handle havingness without handling a problem. You're usually handling some old problem he doesn't know about. Theta is the solver of problems. Mass, energy, space, and time are the problems. When theta believes itself to be mass, energy, space, and time, it itself becomes a problem. But it does this voluntarily so as to have a problem, and a problem is germane to the game. A problem is pertinent to games. Now, I told you that we had several factors involved with games. We had freedom, and we had havingness or entrapment, And we had unpredictability of some sort. And we'll take up now another one of these factors. And don't think the factors are countless. They are not. We rather exhausted them right there. But there is a specialized thing about havingness that you should know. And that is that problem and havingness are very close cousins. And they are interchangeable. So if you want to solve somebody's problems, you give him havingness. It's a commodity. Actually, you can have a person invent problems, and he will, to some degree, remedy his havingness. You see? So these things are cousins. They are not the same thing. But problems lie in the realm of havingness, or havingness lies in the realm of problems, and I will not say which is senior. Really, I will not. Because when a person is worried about problems, he is in the think band, which is below effort. So problems are not postulates. They are the results of applied efforts. And so we get this relationship, and they are cousins simply because they are next to each other on the scale. Now, possibly there are other combinations of one kind or another. Possibly there are other elements as yet undiscovered, because I actually have not thought very hard about the anatomy of games, even though it's quite important. The problem that we were faced with continually was this sort of a problem all the way along the line, havingness. Let's show you how these two things relate to each other. Here in 1950, I was at the end of the track as far as being able to finance research and to carry on writing. It was actually practically breaking my back to audit pre-clears half the day for research purposes and to sit up all night writing stories in order to finance further work, so on. Simply became too great a burden, factually. And when a well-known publisher offered to publish a book on the subject, if I made it popular enough, that was his specification, I did so. And very happily wrote the book. There was another reason for writing the book, and a much better reason for writing the book, was because it made it unnecessary then to tell everybody everything that had been found out to date. And people trying to tell people about Dianetics were coming up against the lack of written material to such a degree that anyone writing anyone about Dianetics would have to write him a couple of thousand-page letter just to get a couple of the ideas across, you see? So a book was very necessary, but here was havingness and the problem. The problem was the mind, and havingness was preventing the lack of, was preventing a ready solution of the matter, because one could not devote enough time to the research and investigation. So one was prone to listen, of course, to individuals who were very happy to organize an organization based upon the fact that the book seemed to already be very popular. And these individuals did organize this organization called the Hubbard Dianetic Research Foundation of Elizabeth, New Jersey. And their goals, however, were havingness. And the solution of the problem, if you will run this little test, you'll be quite edified. Chap has present time problem. You have him invent problems of comparable magnitude. He invents one, you say, that's fine. Now, where is your problem? This would, you would think, sound like an odd question. But he always answers it at once. He said, it's right there. And he points to a spot out in front of him a little bit. And you say, well, fine. Give me. If he can't do this, by the way, he simply interiorized into it. And you ask him another problem of comparable magnitude. That's why you ask him once before you ask him, because you're certain that a certain percentage of your people will have to answer it at least once before they can get the thing far enough in front of them to point. So you ask him for another problem of comparable magnitude, and the chap will give you one, and that's invent one, of course. And you say, where's that problem? You point a little bit further out in front of him. He answers this question seven or eight times, inventing problems of comparable magnitude, with you checking each time as to the position of the problem. And you'll find that this problem will go out there maybe 100, 200 feet. Now, if it gets out that far, it's very likely that it will evaporate. So you want to conduct this test before it evaporates. You want to still have it locatable, because this test doesn't work If you don't grab it, well, it's still locatable. The next question you want to ask him to make this test, not in processing, is, what could you do about it? And make him actually think of what to do about it. And you will find that the problem will, to some degree, come back toward him. Now, how far is it out there? It's only 100 feet out there. Now, what else could you do about it? And he sits there sort of blankly, and you say, now, where is it now? It's 10 feet out in front of him. Now, there's a much worse test that can be made on this, which proves our point much more ferociously. We conduct the first part of the test just the same. Problem comparable magnitude, where is it? Problem comparable magnitude, where is it? We wait till it gets about 40 feet out there, and then we say to him, solve something. And he says, all right, 2 plus 2 equals 4. You say, where's the problem? Let's come back in. You could say, solve something else. And he could say, happily, you know, goofily, he doesn't know what he's doing something. And he could say, well, he says, 10 times 10 equals 100. You say, where's the problem? Well, it's out there about 5 feet. All right, we'll solve something else. Well, water is composed of hydrogen and oxygen. All right, where's the problem now? Well, it's right here. It's right here, and you know, I don't know what I'm going to do about it. And he'll start worrying about it all over again. The ratio between effort and thinkingness is very closely defined with such a test. This is an interesting test. You really ought to make this test. You may make a mistake in making the test, which is to ask him for problem comparable magnitude until it's out there a couple of hundred feet, and while you're thinking up the next question or something of the sort, or another problem comparable magnitude, or ask him to solve something, the problem goes, it's gone, and then you say solve something and nothing happens. The problem then does not repeat itself. It has ceased to become mass. Doesn't come back in then. That's curious, isn't it? But you have denied him a certain amount of mass, and he will get even with you by going aniten or getting agitated. You get the idea. Lots of things are liable to occur, lots of interesting phenomena. If the problem's gone, and then you ask him to solve something and solve something, he doesn't get that problem back. He gets agitated and so on. You kept asking him to solve something, he will eventually think up another present time problem. You'll begin to worry or fixate on another problem, and it, too, will have location. You get a different parade of the same phenomena. All right, if there is a relationship between mass and havingness, it's quite interesting that individuals run out of mass very often when they run out of problems. Why is this? Very fascinating. It's because what we call apparency or isness is composed of an awareness, and it's also composed of a consistency, a continuousness, isn't it? One takes an apparency or an actuality, or as you might call it, reality, and he finds that he is looking at a consistency. Is that right? All right. If he totally looked at this consistency, we understand at once what would happen. If his awareness totally embraced the existing apparency, we wouldn't have it. It would be gone. Why is this? Why? Well, it's just because there is a missing element, and there must be a problem connected with it. But the way the problem is connected with it is not quite as esoteric as just a problem. There must be a hidden factor. There must be some factor which inhibits the as-isness of the mass. Now, let's be much less complicated about this, and let's take a look at this wall over here. If you were really totally aware of the entire and complete manufacture and source of that wall, you'd look through it. You can test this out on a facsimile. You can test this out with ownership processing. Chap has a facsimile, you ask him who made it. Who made it? Who made it? Who made it? And he tells you he made it, and somebody else made it, and somebody else made it. And every time he calls the wrong one, it gets more solid. And you can ask him to call the wrong one with malice aforethought. And it'll get more and more solid, more and more solid, more and more solid, more and more solid. Quite interesting as an experiment. You can take an individual and let him grab onto his tonsillectomy and then insist that he say he made it and he created it. It's a body facsimile, you see. And you have him insist upon this and you get a fascinating phenomenon turning up. You get in its place not just a picture of a tonsillectomy containing a few somatics. You will put him right back in the operating room. You can get the walls of the engram, unless if you're a good auditor, use too much two-way communication and acknowledge too well and so forth, you will as-is it as fast as you're thickening it. So you want to be rather aloof about the whole thing and not communicate very much, you see, in order to really complete this. You have to be sort of a bum auditor to do this experiment. And you can get him to a point where he swears he could have gotten off, could get off the table and knock on the walls and make a noise. Mass is involved when we introduce the problem of misownership, which is the basic and most important problem. So problems are mainly connected with somethingness and nothingness, so that reality itself must contain at all times a problem of one kind or another, which is to say an unsolution, a non-solvingness of some kind in order to get a persistence, and that persistence we call reality. Now you see really what the relationship of a problem is to mass. And it is that relationship. You can do some interesting things with Preclear's thinking of this. You can ask him for a problem of comparable magnitude to the creation of this universe. And if he can ever get around this question and get past his calm wag on the thing, you might trick him by being nice and quiet and just smooth as an auditor so as never to jar his suspicions. You might trick him into triggering the reality of this universe out. It's quite startling when you do this. What I'm telling you is actually based on, you might say, laboratory procedures with tests that have been made along this line that I've made, set up one way or the other. Now, something is very fascinating about this whole thing has to do with the solvingness of a person and mass. A person's willingness to solve problems depends upon his havingness. And if you take some fellow who's awful, awful thin down on havingness and you ask him quietly to solve this and solve that and solve something else and solve something else and solve something else, he sort of gets pretty groggy. He'll go downtown after a while. Now, if you walk up to him with the problem and get his solution on the problem, you're all right, because you did give him the problem, you see. You got how this is. You did give him the problem. He did solve it. Therefore, you have added and subtracted one problem. But there are situations where you could ask him for more solutions than you presented him with problems. See? You bring up this problem. And he says, well, that's very easy. He says, you write this letter to the post office, and they at once tell you where you can get the proper registry stamp or something. And they say, well, I've done that. And they said they didn't have one, and so on. Where do I get this registry stamp? Well, one way to go about it would be to go down here to the stationery store and have it made. Well, I did that, and they said it was illegal to make one. Isn't it interesting that this fellow about this time would get annoyed? Now, you say, perhaps, or would think of it perhaps, as he has a perfect right to be annoyed because his communication's breaking down. No, his communication isn't breaking down. What's breaking down is his terminal. You've given him one problem, you've asked him for two solutions, you're now asking him for a third solution. Wow! You see? And at once you'd run out. He's hiding this. Now, if an executive ever has somebody in the office who can't seem to put a solution into action, and who always has to have a different solution, he's really looking at somebody who is obsessed with the idea of making nothing of the executive. And that's all there is, lies behind it. That's all it is, just an intent to kill. Anyhow, an executive knew that. Interesting time. All right. So you could run down a person's having this by making them solve more problems than were offered. And so it happens that the reverse is true. An individual can actually be offered many more problems than he can solve, at which moment he goes into a confusion. And the confusion is the generation of a very particular kind of mass. Chaos solidifies and becomes mass. He'll develop ridges of one kind or another if this is done. He will actually develop mass. So he'll have ridges across the back of his head, and he'll have ridges through his skull, and he'll have ridges of one kind or another, and his stomach ridges, and so on. These ridges, however, do not, as is, really, on solutions. Why? He was too low on havingness to begin with. You know, the physical universe, this idea of havingness, is darn scarce. So he's a little bit low on havingness. So he took these problems, and their conversion into masses as a misplaced effort to get some havingness. And as a result, he feels quite unwilling to give up these ridges and masses. And you start to as-is them as an auditor, and you run significance, unhappy, and he'll get just as unhappy as he would get at somebody who asked him for several solutions without presenting him with more than one problem. Now, knowing these things and being able to observe these things in real life, we discover another factor, that an individual will communicate as long as he has havingness. And when his havingness runs down, if he's rather aberrated, he'll stop communicating. He'll figure out some new havingness, and he will keep on communicating. But some people go below this point, and thereafter are non-communicative. Now, what do you really find nerve-wracking about a preacher? His calm lags, his inability to cognite. And these things are horrible. There he is, sitting there, and he's wearing his father's face and hair and everything of the sort, and you keep asking, well, has anybody ever been mean to you or anything like this? And he names everybody but his father, and did anybody ever snuffle like that? And no, he never knew a soul. And finally he says, well, father did. Nothing happens at all, you know. But he won't communicate. You say, what person do you know that had hair like you have? And the fellow... Now, you get around people who have lived around this person, and they will be upset about this person. You see, they'll be quite upset because this person has never completed the communication, so therefore is withholding pay. But communication, straight communication, as is his mass. Therefore, it would also as is problems, wouldn't it? So if it as is his mass with this rapidity, which it will do, certainly something has to be there to remedy some mass. So you're going to take some preacher who is non-communicating, and you're going to use communication to make him well. Nope. Some of these people are so bad off that you start to run an inventory on them, and the corners of the room will suddenly go askew. The physical universe starts to as is right in front of their eyes. Oh, man, when you get hold of one of those, the only thing wrong with this person is simply having this down. That's all. And you wonder why this person doesn't communicate. Well, if you force this person to communicate, this person, by the way, is not always thin. The most interesting preclear along this line, the one who has it the most, is usually very fat. Very fat. Fatter than anybody here or anybody listening to this tape. But The fact of the matter is that these people are trying to compensate to such a degree and all the time know so well that they can't have, that they just keep stacking it up, stacking it up, stacking it up. Well, these people have peculiar ideas of communication, believe me. They won't give up any of this mass, this artificial mass that they've accumulated. So they'll communicate in peculiar and oblique ways, and they will try never to be direct. They will try to be a problem in communication in an effort to make their problems remedy their havingness as fast as they talk. And you should look rather sympathetically upon this, because the poor chap's caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. If he talks, he'll lose mass. If he doesn't talk, why, he'll just get fatter and fatter. And there it is. Poor fellow. All right. Now, you give an inventory or engage in a great deal of communication about his current problems and his troubles. Now, you will have enough success communicating about somebody's problems and troubles and having them go away as a result, because you get an as-isness of mass. And of course, there is such a thing as logic and reason and appeal and friendship and these other things. You might just give him you see, as a terminal and solve his problems. You're there talking to him. This might be enough, providing he's aware that you're there. You might have enough success in doing this to lead you entirely astray, as we were led entirely astray in the first days of the discovery of the efficacy of communication. You would think, then, that the panacea for all ills was communication. It is not. Most people, you can get away with it, but you wouldn't get away with it four times. So that toward the end of an intensive, a long two-hour period, you know, two-way communication, we two-way calmed for an hour or two, you know, that went fine at the beginning of the intensive, but toward the end of the intensive, it's not going fine anymore. We're finding the preclear getting antagonistic, drifting off from the session, getting upset, and we say he's getting into re-stimulation or something. No, we have communicated him out of his havingness and out of his problems, which is to say out of his havingness. He can have havingness as long as there's a problem or a hiddenness about the havingness. There must be something wrong with its authorship. There must be something undisclosable about the whole thing, or he'll lose it. And he has to be able then to invent a problem to have. An individual who knows he is mocking up is liable after a very short time to lose totally his mock-up ability. You insist that he knows he is mocking up. You insist, just pound and hammer him until he knows positively that he himself put up mock-up there, and you're just fine. And the machine puts up the last feeble mock-up via, you see, and then no mock-up. Chap's liable to worry about this, you know. And until he recovers an ability to just straight postulate mass into a continuing existence, which is also feasible, remember, he comes off the via system, the problem mass system, we can call that, onto the straight postulate mass system, he goes through a period of no mock-up. And you will notice this in remedying headings, getting people to mock things up. And he goes through a period of annoyance, too. He puts out earth, and he put out earth perfectly. You'd say, all right, now make a mock-up of earth. That's fine. Now push it into your body. That's fine. Good. Make up another mock-up of earth. That's fine. Push in the beautiful mock-ups. You know, they got mass and so forth. And you say, now, you sure you're mocking that up? Now you mock that up, you say, or something like that. And so he mocks up one of earth, thinner. Mock up one of earth, thinner. Mock up one of earth, thinner. Mock up one of earth, no mock-up. His dependency upon the machine now becomes apparent. If you ask him to keep on trying it, however, you will bring him through. And he will eventually, it isn't really necessary, by the way, to do this. You're simply taking over the automaticity of a machine. It isn't necessary to run drills of this character. It just happens in auditing, that's all. Somewhere along the line in remedying heaviness, making mock-ups, that sort of thing, he will lose this automaticity and he'll go blank. And when he all of a sudden can't get mock-ups anymore, this is not the time for you to let him have a lose. You accept this as a matter of course, congratulate him, swat him on the back, any way you want to give him a little more havingness, because he'll get scared about havingness at that point. And have him just continue the mock-up and he will recover his ability to postulate its there-ness and its continuing there-ness. And one should simply be able to postulate a mass out here and say, there it is, and it's continuing to be there. You see, that's well within the realm of postulate ability. Individuals, however, don't like to go around postulating and saying this about everything, and so they develop this other system. The other system is problems, havingness, so on. It's a via system, leaving something unknown in the actuality of the universe. All right. As you work preclears, then, you will discover them coming off of systems consecutively and continuously. They are always coming off of systems into a simplified, more simple system, as you audit them well. They are always adopting a simpler, more direct approach until at last they can speak in straight lines, not curves. It almost follows as a curve the evolution of Dianetics and Scientology. It's become simpler, simpler, simpler. And we have gotten, of recent months, several dips where we went suddenly into greater complication and then curved up again into greater simplicity. And then this simplicity would run into a deeper complication, many more vias, and it looked so complicated no auditor could ever grasp that. I thought of that three or four times. Just think of having to teach this theory right now the way it exists, you know. It'd fill a book on some particular subject. And then in a day, 2, 6 days, something like that, all of a sudden the thing would simplify. Its common denominator would be discovered, and there we'd get a simpler theory than before. And we'd say, well, that's fine, that's the simplest thing there is, and all we need to do now, we just teach this, we say, bah, and we taught the whole class, you see, and everybody knows all about it now, and they know about it perfectly, and that's that. The only trouble is we say bye and always have to say poo-bah right afterwards, you see. And then an auditor gets it in his hands, and he wants it more thoroughly described. And the next thing you know, it's the most complicated balderdash you ever listened to, and we have to abandon the whole thing. You see how this is. Well, SLP-5 was a very, very fine tool. So was SOP-8. Way back when. It's in Scientology 88008, which you should read. Way back when. The same thing happened to both of them. Auditors got at them, and it was found that there were missing elements. There was something there that could go wrong. People could make mistakes with it, and preclears could hang up with it. So it required refinement. In the process of getting that refinement, we, of course, have to learn a very great deal. I work on this principle, that if an auditor can make mistakes with the problem, I do not really question the intent of the auditor. I always assume that he is doing his best, the best way he can, within his own lights. And you know I'm never wrong. Really never wrong. The impulses on which he is operating may be highly misdirected and so forth, but he's still trying to do his best. He's still trying to help people all he can. His intentions are quite honest. Something may carry him away into the wrong stream of thought, but nevertheless, it has been my consistent discovery, perhaps because it's based on a basic postulate and a basic belief in man at large, that he has never done these things maliciously or viciously. You see, he's trying all the way along the line. And therefore, it's a very, very safe thing to hand things into the hands of auditors and find out what goes wrong. Because they'll tell you. There are chaps in Scientology who are very, very good at theory. Very, very good at theory. They'll revolve on occasion Scientology theory and that sort of thing. Recap it. And their work is always done with an honesty and a forward effort that is really very fine. And it's always of assistance. Always. A great deal of the work simply tells me that the fellow never got down to brass tacks in the first place. Quite a bit of it, you see. He's missing something basic. But a fair percentage of it is very original and very well put and very well organized and has to a very marked degree contributed to what we know. Very often, some chap that I've poked the hole in a theory of, you know, I say, look at that. That's dead wrong. He often thinks, boy, has he made nothing out of me. Man, am I invalidated. And I have to square around and tell him, you're not invalidated. You just showed me something. Thank you, you know, that sort of thing. Because if this is the way you think on that subject, then we need a coordination here. And in trying to explain to you how you're thinking on that subject, we get a meeting ground and we get closer to the truth. And so we are working closer and closer to truth. And we find, oddly enough, that a truth would consist of exactly nothing. And maybe this is what Siddhartha meant when he said mind essence. Maybe Siddhartha was trying to make nothing out of everybody. But unfortunately, a preacher doesn't survive long enough to reach the nothingness. Now, wherever we go, and whoever we process, we discover this to be true. Somewhere along the line, the preclear, a Thetan, revolts. He goes into agitation, which is quite marked. And if you were a very good auditor, you will see it go twitch, twitch. You know, you will see the earliest beginnings of agitation as he begins to run out of havingness. The earliest beginning, you should see it. Hardly be any twitch at all. But you should detect the difference between merely excited motions and various attitudes, such as, well, he squiggles down the chair. He feels a little more comfortable about something. That is not an agitation. The agitation sometimes only shows up in his voice. He suddenly says, yes, yes, that's right, you know, and he's been talking rather calmly, and he says, oh, well, if you continue to do what you were doing without doing something about havingness, for maybe one more auditing command, he would become agitated. You see, he's not agitated yet. You want to read that early. That's a smooth auditor. So he's pretty clear, always goes along like a breeze. You know, there's no bombshells being dropped. Now, the other one is, the pretty clear starts to dope off. And when he starts to dope off, you should catch the earliest moment of the dope. Don't let him go blank. Don't let him go blank. Catch the first instant of the dope. Sometimes he simply goes into a dope off by gradual degrees of slump. You see him slump. No self-satisfied slump. There's nothing else goes with it. He just slumps a little more. Just a little more. Well, if you don't catch it by the second one, you're not being very hot. Because about the third one, he goes, bud. He goes fast when he goes. It's interesting that sometimes the body will go anaten on a fairly alert preclear, and the Thetan will stay very alert, totally able to talk and so forth, but the body goes anaten. This is a curiosity. Well, that certainly should tell you what's happening. It's just simply a reduction of havingness. Now, a reduction of havingness then results in one of these two things. And there isn't any reason to get theoretical about which one results in what, because they both result from the same thing. There's simply the havingness is working differently. The absence of it is either stretching the nervous system of the body and the Thetan's beams, beaneries, beameries, that's it. And the other is that it is throwing into re-stimulation a great deal of aniten. One or the other is occurring, and evidently these are the two manifestations. Now, it so happens that as many people really, I suppose, go unconscious, being given a problem they cannot solve that is overwhelming, has become alert and nervous and agitated. Suddenly, the car goes out of control, and one chap is sitting there behind the wheel, and the car goes out of control, and he goes, "Dah." He actually just quits right there. Quits cold. And the other chap, car goes out of control, and the fellow says, "Oh, my God, my God, my God." See? Goes up tight. Now, these are really actually two different positions on the tone scale. And both of them are symptoms of out of control. And when we get out of controlness on the part of a body or a GE, we get, of course, one of the two things. There are many panaceas for this agitation. One of the more curious little phenomena of mock-up processing is flip-flopping, which hasn't been around for quite a long time, but is very useful. It's a remedy of havingness of one sort or another, but you tell him to mock up his body and have it flip-flop. Have it flip-flop all over the place, tell him. Now, mock it up again and have it flip-flop all over. Have it bounce off the ceiling and the walls. Make it flip-flop. And he does this a few times, and the out-of-controlness in the mass is erased by his taking it over as an automaticity, you see. Now, this is just a little bit different type of thing. It is havingness that has become a problem, a body out of control. So there's the problem, and you can do almost what you want about the problem. You would get as much sense of, give me a problem of comparable magnitude to a body going out of control. Right? You probably get the same result as running flip-flopping. It would, as is the out-of-controlness, by adding in enough out-of-controlness to satisfy even the preclear. You want to be very chary, then, in auditing, of making nothing out of anything. You just want to be chary of it in auditing. Don't worry about it. If you erase a preclear, erase half of him, or erase his head, or something like that, just chalk it up to luck, you know. Some days you're sorry you got up, you know. And you know, you can't win times. Maybe you had a hangover. But the main thing about it is don't get to fighting this making nothing out of things, because life is a succession of somethingnesses and nothingnesses. Every instant which goes by is an instant in which, appalling thought, the entire universe is obliterated and entirely mocked up again. Every instant this occurs. It may occur as often as 1 over 186,000 times a second. Let me think about it. You didn't know you were that good, did you? You're that good. Now, as you think this over, though, it becomes quite compelling. It's all gone, isn't it? Where was the moment in which I said that last word? Where's the universe that was here then? Well, man, that's making nothing out of things in a hurry, isn't it? Huh? That is the most gargantuan making nothingness that you could, at this instant, I'm sure, imagine here. That instant's gone. But with it went an entire universe. Right now, the Colosseum in Rome stands there, a great deal of mass. And we say, look at all that from the past. Oh, no, you don't. Look at all that we're putting there right now. It's not from the past. We are following the form. It is new at some fabulous rate of speed. But it is a mock-up of an old ruin, which was always a mock-up of something. You get the idea? There never was a time when it was more actual or less actual than it is right now. There was a time when it had a different, quote, newer, unquote, form. In other words, our mock-ups hadn't included it so often. And I think that things decay simply because mock-up machinery gets tired of duplicating them. And it starts leaving out the fine, sharp edges. Sort of a laziness occurs there. And the fine, sharp edges start disappearing. And after that, why, you say, well, it's gone that far. Let's not even mock up the knobs on it anymore, you know. Well, the devil with that. Let's not. I understand there's some story around here that some soldiers stole the two front gates. Let's not mock them up anymore at all. And so they sort of gone. But this is the way it goes. We don't care what mechanism it goes on, and you shouldn't keep looking for the mechanism unless you're trying to make nothing out of everything. There must be a hidden mechanism for a generality of mock-up like this universe to occur. Well, that didn't make you feel so good, knowing that the whole universe was going gone, 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 gone. Well, now somebody comes along the line and tells us all, look, I just told you, except I'm going to tell you the rest of it. They say, the boast of heraldry and the pomp of power and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, away to like the coming of the hour, the paths of glory lead but to the grave. Well, damn it, they also lead to the next delivery table. But they never mention that, do they? They also lead to the next birth. You see? But people who have lost their power of forecast or prediction and who are less able to envision a future always then look at the past and its vanishment. Now I want to show you the other side of this. Boy, you're sure good. Look what you're putting here every instant. Do you realize the magnitude of the undertaking of mocking up this entire universe? This whole earth? The hugeness of all the stars and the great vast distances amongst them? That's quite an undertaking. And you're mocking that up every instant. Now that's pretty darn smart of you. There's even a technique that goes with it. You say, close your eyes. Now open them up and find a new world. Good. Close your eyes. Now open them up and find a new world. Now close your eyes. Now open them up and find a new world. You run this on a preclear and he's liable to say, my, that's a wonderful process. It's the first time he ever looked at it that way. He's been doing it this way. He's been saying, no, it's all gone. Well, it's all gone. Well, it's all gone. Now the difference between saying it's all gone and look at the new world is the difference between creation and destruction. By we saying it's all gone, our concentration is on destroy, destroy, destroy. By saying look at the new world, our concentration is on creation. It's really only necessary to put somebody's concentration on creation in order to get him into that frame of mind of, gee, look what just appeared, you know. Gosh, look what just appeared. Hey, what just appeared, you know? Then he gets into that frame of mind instead of the other frame of mind. Just difference of attitude. It's just his considerations of the situation. But, oddly enough, he'll make an awful lot of labor for himself in trying to change that condition of mind. You, in essence, are changing that condition of mind. It's not vitally necessary. You shouldn't try to concentrate on changing that because a cycle of action is simply a consideration. That's the truth. The cycle of action is not necessarily create, survive, destroy. The cycle of action might as well be destroy, survive, create. It might as well be survive, create, destroy. It might as well be destroy, create, and then survive. You can find instances of all three. You can make up other factors and enter them into the same thing. You could say create sideways, survive, destroy, you know. All actions will end at right angles to actions which began. You could do almost anything you wanted to with a cycle of action. But it's just plotted out against time, and it happens that we're all agreed that this is going along on this basis. But we might as well say it's survive, destroy, create. Survive, destroy, create. Well, you see at once that it might as well be to survive, destroy, create, as create, survive, destroy. You see why? Because create is always going to follow destroy. So we might as well put it there. And it gives us a much brighter look at things, doesn't it? Maybe we consider the whole thing that way. All right, now as we roll along with our material and we look at our SLP, Issue 8, we then study it and use it from another standpoint. And the other standpoint is just as open your eyes and look at it all there, you know, is quite different than figure, look at all that has been. Well, as ising everything and making nothing out of everything, insisting that everything go back to nothingness, will at once cause us to arrive at some sort of a state of mind of it all was. So our present time is a state of all wasness. And therefore, we become unhappy about it. Now, you were quite interested in delivering into a Thetan's hands, quote unquote. a little bit of power. If he had a little bit of power, he could resist all this energy. He could have all this energy. He could mock up all this energy. If his beams had amperage and wattage, he could do this easily, couldn't he? Well, how do you give him the amperage and wattage? What is this thing called strength? Is it really the ability to create, the ability to destroy? No, that is the cycle of action. It is simply a relationship. You are very strong compared to a matchbox, aren't you? The matchbox is easily part of your allness. Are you very strong compared to the physical universe? No, you're part of the physical universe's allness. Only you're real weak if you're separate from the physical universe's allness. And that's the weakest thing of all. The only one who is separate from the physical universe's allness. So we look at all this havingness being destroyed and created, one right after the other, and how would we possibly ever overcome this or take any advantage of it or get squared around or develop any amperage or wattage or be able to handle energy or space? If it's so necessary to handle the stuff, we certainly had better be able to handle it. Well, you won't be able to handle it if you are not part of it. If you're always separate from the spaces and the energies you're trying to handle, you are not in accordance with one of the basic rules necessary to the handling of spaces and energies. One of those basic rules is you must have a separateness and a connectedness and a partness of. Unless you have these things, a spaceship all by itself will not move. A spaceship has to be a part of the universe in which it moves. So, there's a direct coordination between what of this physical universe is the preclear willing to have as delivered to his, into his hands by Mesh Universe Havingness Processing and his ability to use power in this universe. All you have to do is get him up to a point where he can have, dispense with, or let remain, or in this proper order, have, let remain, and dispense with the universe. He can be separate from it or with it at will. And you'll find his voltage and amperage is actually there. You see how this would be? So there is a direct route between havingness and the development of force or power. And one's engram bank would not collapse on him if he himself were capable of handling force and power. So this is the direct route. This is one of the many routes, but it is still a very direct route. It's one of these all routes. And why is it an all route? People who are incapable of handling this universe or their own banks have withdrawn and retreated from this universe to such a degree that they stand as only ones and they're no longer a part of this universe and they cannot accept any part of this universe and they certainly would not let the universe form any part of them. And so their energy as generated can then perform no part of this universe. The only one that makes universe lightning is some being they know not what of, then they're disenfranchised from the game. And being disenfranchised from the game into being an only one, they no longer can exert force and power upon the universe. But once the universe is theirs, or they can have it, or somebody else can have it, at will, they can then exert force and power, and their engram bank doesn't bother them much anymore. So through havingness and separateness, which is the third stage, what could you dispense with? It means what could you be separate from? We have, of course, these two ingredients, as long as the preclear doesn't totally run out of unpredictabilities or problems. If he doesn't run out of those while he is getting his havingness and his freedom, he, of course, will come up to a point where he can handle all of this stuff. And that's where we want him to go, and that's where we ourselves would like to be. And that is the road we travel in order to get there. Thank you.
Thank you.